Alpha Kappa Alpha is the oldest sorority founded by African American women. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Alpha Kappa Alpha is a sisterhood like any other sorority, but this one was founded by a handful of women one generation out from slavery who wanted to make the most of their education and their lives. Deborah Whaley is an assistant professor of American and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. I'll talk with her about the history of that sorority and other black Greek letter organizations. We'll explore their culture, their political influence, and their impact on society and the people who participate. Later on, I'll talk with Tyler Hakes. He's the editor-in-chief of Above Ground Magazine, an online magazine about the world of hip-hop. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll be talking with the creator of Above Ground Magazine, an online magazine dedicated to hip-hop music and culture. But first, the culture and politics of African-American sororities and fraternities. Deborah Whaley is an assistant professor of American Studies and African-American Studies at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of Disciplining Women, Alpha Kappa Alpha, Black Counterpublics, and the Cultural Politics of Black Sororities. Deborah, thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure.
And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. If you were a member of an African-American fraternity or sorority, we'd love to hear about your personal experiences and your thoughts on the culture and politics of these organizations. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's start with Alpha Kappa Alpha. That's the major African-American sorority. It was the first one founded in 1908. What was the genesis of the organization?
Well, the sorority started in 1908, as you mentioned, at Howard University. And the original conceiver of the sorority was Ethel Hedgeman Lyle, who was a student at Howard. And she was followed by 15 additional women who wanted to start a sorority to create sisterhood, but to also have an outlet to work on various types of community service projects, to engage in civil rights activism, as well as to engage in the fight for women's rights. So while it was a sorority, it served additional purposes too. It acted as an outlet for activism for the women.
And in those early years, what kinds of activities did the women of that sorority take part in?
So we're talking about the turn of the century, right? So basically, these women were just coming out of the shadows of slavery. So it wasn't too far past the moment when people of African descent were enslaved. And so in 1908, African Americans were in a marginalized position. So they would naturally think of ways to try to respond to their situation as black women, being disenfranchised because of race. At that time, women were not allowed to vote. African Americans still faced various roadblocks to voting in different sites, especially in the South, as we all know. And so there was lots of work to be done. It was a moment of lynching was still a concern and continued to be a concern for years and years after their formation. So there were all these things going on in society that they wanted to respond to as college-educated women.
And as you said, college-educated women, this was 1908. That's pretty unusual at that time for African-American women to be college-educated.
Absolutely. And the sorority began at a historically black college, as I mentioned, Howard. And while there were roadblocks for African-Americans in general in terms of just being able to be a full citizen of society because of racism, the women at Howard University faced increased obstacles because of their gender as well. So they had to sort of think of ways to fight on both fronts, for women's rights and for racial ethnic rights as African-American women.
Well, I want to talk more about Alpha Kappa Alpha and how it evolved in these other organizations, but I also want to take a moment to talk about your interest in these organizations. You write in your book that your interest really was piqued when your sister pledged to Alpha Kappa Alpha in 1989. What did you see her go through? You talk about watching her change before your eyes. What did you see her go through at the beginning that made you really think?
Well, just want to back up a bit. I have a legacy of fraternity and sorority members within my family. My father is a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, a black fraternity. And so most of what we did in terms of social types of interactions was related to my father's fraternity. So I already had a lot of experience with the culture of black fraternities.
But you also write that you didn't really think about that as a kid. It was just something that was part of what you did.
It was just part of what we did, and I was very young, and so you're correct in that. It wasn't until I was in college myself, my sister had already been in college for a few years, that I began to see really sort of close up what the process was to go through initiation. So while my father was in a fraternity, everything we engaged in was sort of post his initiation. But with my sister, several things. We grew up in California, San Jose, California, in a suburb predominantly white. And she was a student at San Jose State University. I was a student at UC Santa Cruz. And I saw for her the sorority became a site wherein she could get to know other African-American women, to have African-American women as friends, to think about ways to make changes in society, especially locally in the Bay Area. And so I saw her become more confident. I saw her have the opportunity to gain friendships, to become active in the community. And the overall transformation that I saw was just that of a confident, motivated woman who was thinking about ways to intervene in society with her other sorority sisters.
Did you see other changes in her as well? I think you wrote about how there is a way of dressing and a way of wearing one's hair and things that you saw your sister conforming to.
Absolutely. Well, before my sister pledged, I would see other pledges. And so the idea is, and this is this was before the ban on pledging. So the idea with pledging is that the pledges wear the same clothes, they walk in unison, they wear similar hairstyles. And so I saw that all from afar. But when my sister pledged, I saw her doing all of that, but I ended up seeing more. And so all the sort of things that you see from the outside in terms of what may look like conformity, the other side of that is that in that supposed conformity, the idea is that the women are trying to create a platform to bond, to get to know each other, and to become a part of an organization that has a larger vision.
You describe yourself as both an insider and an outsider because you did see your sister go through this. Your father was in a black fraternity, mm-hmm. but you yourself did not pledge.
Yes, I didn't pledge. On a couple of occasions when I was an undergraduate, was invited to go to a meeting of interest. And it was just not something that I was interested in doing at the time. But I do see myself as an insider and an outsider because I had so much exposure to Black Greek life, not just with my sister and my father, but I have two legacies within my family, Alpha Kappa Alpha and Kappa Alpha Psi. So all of my uncles on my dad's side were Kappas, many, many AKAs in my family. So I grew up in that culture, but I'm still an outsider because I'm not a member.
I think a lot of people listening right now are probably more familiar with the modern Greek system that we see at universities all over the place. How would you compare and contrast predominantly Black Greek letter organizations with the other mainstream sororities and fraternities that we see now?
I think the major difference is because we're talking about people who are of African descent and who have been marginalized in society because of race or gender or both, the Black Greek letter organizations acted as a site wherein they could engage in activism. So I think with the other sort of mainstream sororities and fraternities, although they also do work in communities as well, there wasn't this sort of pressing need to engage in civil rights to emancipate themselves. themselves, as there were with members of Black Greek letter organizations. And so there's this sort of political aspect and the aspect of civic engagement, but there's also the cultural aspect too. So there's all types of rites and rituals and cultural aspects of Black Greek letter organizations that set them apart, whether that's engaging in the cultural practice of stepping and step shows, or whether that's thinking about ways to integrate into initiation things that are particular to people of African descent. And the other difference is that while there are many Greek letter organizations, not just in white communities and African-American communities, but there are Latino Greek letter organizations, et cetera, who also have political platforms. But for Black Greek letter organizations, there is this consecrated effort to think about ways to engage in politics and revivify culture.
As these organizations have evolved, I mean, obviously when they started, there was a need for suffrage. There was a need for working on many civil rights issues. And of course, the civil rights struggle continued and in many ways continues today. But as time went on, and let's talk about Alpha Kappa Alpha, because that's the sorority that you focus on. How has the mission of this organization changed?
Well, it changes with the times. So in the 1980s, they were heavily involved in the fight to end South African apartheid. The work never ended for African-American sororities because people of African descent still face obstacles in society. So that continues to be a pressing concern for the women. So henceforth, they continue to work in various educational programs and political programs, not just within the U.S., but also in Africa and in other parts of the world. So although we're in the sort of modern era where we have the vote, African Americans have a litany of rights that came out of the civil rights movement, there is still not arguably equality across the board for all people. So issues of social justice remain a concern.
My guest is Deborah Whaley. She's an assistant professor of American Studies and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of a book called Disciplining Women, about the culture of Black Greek letter organizations. And we'll talk more about that culture, both ancient and modern, in just a moment. We'll talk also a little bit about the stepping, which is something that is practiced commonly among these organizations and has really broken out into popular culture as well. So we'll talk more about that in a moment. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
I see you, Tamika!
I see people wearing pearls all the time.
Don't be fooled, Detective. You know a real pearl when you see one.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking right now about the culture of Black Greek letter organizations, African-American sororities and fraternities. My guest is Deborah Whaley. She's an assistant professor of American Studies and African-American Studies at the University of Iowa. She's written a book about these organizations. It's called Disciplining Women, Alpha Kappa Alpha, Black Counterpublics and the Cultural Politics of Black Sororities. In about 15 minutes, we'll also be talking about hip-hop, and we'll talk with the young proprietor of an online magazine called Above Ground Magazine. But right now, we'll continue our conversation about African-American sororities and fraternities. And if you've been a part of one of these organizations, we'd love to hear about your experiences. Or if you have any questions, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we do have a question that came in by email from someone who chose to remain anonymous. But their question is, I've heard that some Black fraternities and sororities were based on skin color. If your skin was too dark, you couldn't get in. Is that true?
Well, there is this sort of history of colorism in in American life, not just in America, but also in other sites. And so there is this stereotype of Greek letter organizations as well as social organizations and various types of fraternal, not necessarily Greek fraternities and sororities, but just fraternal organizations in general that have the stigma of engaging in colorism. And so one of the things I wanted to do in the book is to do what no one else had done, which is to take the issue of colorism on directly. And so while in other works on Greek letter organizations, there has been this sort of tendency to either deny it or kind of skirt around it, what I decided to do in the book is to compare the difference between the organizations that emerged at historically black colleges vis-a-vis the organizations that emerged and the chapters that formed at predominantly white colleges. And one of the things I found through my research is that at predominantly black colleges, such as Howard, whereas, you know, before I was sort of talking about the women sort of thinking about ways to address their racial ethnic oppression and their gender oppression at Howard University, they were in a homogeneous environment. And so there became ways in which sometimes in a predominantly black environment, modes of distinction would take place. And so that would be on the basis of color, and that would be on the basis of class as well. The other thing is that one of the things I try to do in the book is not to, well, to dispel the myth that black Greek letter organizations are sort of a copy of white Greek letter organizations. They really sort of stemmed out of existing African secret societies and black social fraternities and sororities as a whole, who also had issues with color and class distinctions. And so that sort of carried on with some of the chapters in some sites, especially at historically black colleges, where when you're in a homogeneous environment, people begin to sort of find ways to distinguish themselves from others in a hierarchical and in a very, very problematic way. That being said, the issue of colorism is not something that's just sort of something that African Americans do or promote, right? We have an issue with color in society as a whole. And so I guess I would just sort of close with saying that while there is absolutely some evidence that modes of distinction such as colorism and classism took place, another dimension is that because these groups were forming, as I said before, really in the shadows of slavery, oftentimes those who were able to gain a college education were those who came out of the sort of slave caste system, wherein the lighter your skin was, the more advantages you had, such as education. So we're already talking about a pool of people able to gain an education who oftentimes were of a lighter hue. So several factors working. And I think Spike Lee's film School Days tried to address the situation, although in a highly problematic way, which was another reason why I wanted to write the book, is to take on the issue of colorism and to talk about its genesis, its background, the way it's transformed over time, and to dispel the myth that it's widespread in Alpha Kappa Alpha, or that it's something that is a part of their modern practices.
I think what you're saying is it has been a problem at times. It's not necessarily a special problem to this organization, because it's something that happens in many ways across society.
Right. Absolutely.
The organizations that we're talking about do a lot of service. They engage in a lot of political action, but they're not particularly vocal about what they do. There's not a lot of publicity that surrounds these activities. And I guess, to compare them to more mainstream sororities and fraternities that most of us would be familiar with, that's not the case. You know, most organizations and most organizations, period, talk a lot about the service that they do and the kind of action that they take. Why would these black letter or black Greek letter organizations be more secretive about their activities?
One of the things I found out from my interviews is that while the women do engage in a multiplicity of social, cultural, political platforms, they don't feel the need to publicize it because the idea is to work within the African-American community to enact change. So the goal is change, not acknowledgement, not sort of being out in the forefront and being recognized. The idea is to get the work done that needs to be done within their communities.
Let's talk a little bit about modern organizations and some of the culture. You mentioned the movie School Days, which is one of the movies that kind of shows these organizations. There's another movie called Stomp the Yard that also features this kind of organization. And the focus of that movie are the stepping rituals, stepping contests. Tell me a little bit about stepping for people who may have never seen what it is.
Sure. Well, stepping started in African-American fraternities in the early 20th century, and it's sort of this cultural mixture of African dance elements as well as sort of military drilling type of movements. One of the African-American fraternities, Omega Psi Phi, were also, added to the element of stepping from their experience being in the army, added to stepping sort of various military drilling types of movements. And then as time has gone on and dance aesthetics have changed, there continues to be other aspects that the organizations integrate. And so what started as something that African-American fraternities did soon sort of trickled down to African-American sororities. And so, as I said, as new sort of dance aesthetics became popular, the organizations were implementing forms of Black American dance, African dance, military drilling, and all these sort of different forms to create a cultural practice that sets them apart from the mainstream organizations.
There's also chanting involved.
There is chanting, which is another cultural aspect. So the organizations develop certain signature calls, certain types of language and prose that they develop that's particular to that organization. And so stepping allows a platform to talk about the founding of their organization, to engage in sort of Black verbal vernacular forms, as well as to create a dance aesthetic.
Well, let's hear a little bit of audio from a step show here for a moment. So that's just a little bit of sound from an Alpha Kappa Alpha step show. When these shows take place, what's going on? Is there a competition element to it?
There is a competition element. A large part of my book was based on ethnography. I did not only looking at pledging and initiation rituals, but going to step shows. And so in step shows, you have African-American fraternities competing against other African-American fraternities, African-American sororities competing against other African-American sororities. And so there's an audience there. You pay to get into the show, so it becomes a fundraiser. And so the groups who are competing against each other, there's a winner. And the winner not only gets the proceeds, a portion of the proceeds for those who paid to get into the step show, but there's also a monetary prize for those who win. And so it becomes a way to raise money for the undergraduates for their community service programs. And so it's this really interesting two-way type of performance wherein you have the organizations performing on stage, but you also have the audience members who become a part of it. So whether it's their sorority and fraternity brothers and sisters in the audience cheering them on, or college students, or just people from the community who are cheering on the people performing.
How do you think the rise of the step culture has changed sororities and fraternities? It sounds like it's become a real focus of a number of organizations.
It has become a real focus, and insofar as how it's change the organizations, I think it continues to be. I mean, we were sort of talking before about why don't the black sororities and fraternities sort of advertise what they do. Stepping is one of the very few public aspects of these organizations. So I think it's become a way to publicly sort of make it clear what the cultural center of these organizations constitute. And that is through this form of African and Black American dance that also integrates, as we were talking about before, very sort of vernacular, verbal modes of expression.
We've talked quite a bit about the historical role of Alpha Kappa Alpha and other organizations like this. How about in the modern world? What do you feel is the place of Alpha Kappa Alpha and other black sororities and fraternities right now?
Well, in the 21st century, we're at a moment where we have an African-American president. Many people refer to the 21st century as a clearly post-civil rights era. That being said, as I said before, African-American college students still face isolation on college campuses. They still have the yearning to make connections to other African-Americans. And so because they're remains sort of work to be done in the community. We remain a minority in society. The work of the sorority and fraternity also remains to create an outlet for people who are interested in doing community service, for people who are interested in learning forms of African dance through stepping, to create friends and networks within their community.
Well, you mentioned the fact that we have an African-American president, but more notably, we have an African-American First Lady who was a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha. What does that mean to the organization?
Well, I think for the organization, they consider it to be a feather in their cap, to use a popular phrase. Michelle Obama was recently inducted into Alpha Kappa Alpha, so she didn't pledge as an undergraduate. She came in through the graduate chapter level. And I think the sorority considers it an honor that she accepted, although it did cause a bit of controversy, which I talk about in my book. And so there was the idea that some people felt, you know, there was a bit of aggrandizing going on once she decided to become a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha. And it was sort of, you know, people had a question of why AKA, why not Delta Sigma Theta? And so there was lots of controversy about her coming into the organization. But I think the women themselves definitely see someone like Michelle Obama as the type of activist and the type of person who's interested in issues of social justice that they would like to have a part of the organization.
Post-college, what kind of involvement? You talk about how your father was a fraternity brother, and that informed your social interactions as a child. What is it like now for people who have been a part of one of these organizations? Does that kind of social interaction continue long past college?
It does. And one of the differences between the historically black organizations and the predominantly white organizations is that the majority of the work actually starts after you graduate. And so graduate chapters tend to be much more active than the undergraduate chapters because at that point they have the means, they have the resources, they're older. And so activism really increases at the graduate level.
Do you think that these organizations are as relevant now as they were during the civil rights era?
I think they absolutely are. You know, as I continue to say, although things have gotten better, arguably, you know, various modes of discrimination still exist in society. But, you know, responding to issues of discrimination and community activism isn't the only reason why Black Greek Letter Organization exists. It's also a social outlet as well. And so I think there will always be the need for people to try to connect to others when they feel isolated. I think there will always be the need to socialize. And I think there, you know, as the times changes, there will always be certain types of social justice projects that people will want to respond to, whether it's within the U.S. as Alpha Kappa Alpha does, or whether it's abroad as Alpha Kappa Alpha has been very active in starting schools in Africa and all types of global activism and human rights initiatives across the world.
And it's also become a subgenre of fiction.
It has. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah, for your time today.
Thank you.
Deborah Whaley is an assistant professor of American Studies and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. Her book is called Disciplining Women, Alpha Kappa Alpha, Black Counterpublics, and the Cultural Politics of Black Sororities. And coming up in just a moment, we're going to turn to a different topic. We're going to get into the world of hip-hop music with a young man, Tyler Hakes, who is a recent graduate of the University of Iowa, who's also the creator and editor-in-chief of a magazine called Above Ground Magazine. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And now we turn to the world of hip-hop music. Tyler Hakes is a recent graduate of the University of Iowa. He's also the creator and editor-in-chief of a hip-hop magazine called Above Ground. You can find it online at abovegroundmagazine.com. And Tyler, I think that because this has been a source of a great deal of conversation in the office over the last couple of days before you came in, I think the first thing we need to talk about is what is the difference between rap and hip-hop?
Well, hip hop is technically it's like a culture, and it encompasses rap music, graffiti art, breakdancing, DJing. I guess like in its original form that's what it was. So rap music is basically a subset or a piece of the overall hip hop culture.
All right. And how did you get hooked on this kind of music?
It's kind of an interesting story, I guess. When I was growing up, I guess I just kind of stumbled on it on my own, or partially through like, you know, MTV, when I was younger. And I listened to it for a while, and after a while I actually got kind of turned off by it, because it wasn't really like the things that I'd been exposed to weren't really, things that I could relate to as well.
So what kinds of things turned you off?
If you think about like what's like the mainstream in hip hop, the subject matter of, you know, drugs and violence and that's what the stereotype that people think of. And that's the kind of stuff that I guess, like I said, that kind of turned me off because it's not things that I can relate to, obviously. And later, probably when I was around 15 or 16, I actually met a guy from New York, and he's a producer in New York. And he kind of put me onto this world of what people call like underground or like independent hip hop, which is people that are making rap music, but it can deviate slightly to incredibly from what the mainstream construct is of rap music as a genre. So it's a lot different, and I could relate to that a lot more. So that's kind of what got me interested in that particular kind of facet of hip hop in general.
Describe for me some of the things that you discovered at that point when you started to explore the underground world of hip hop. What were some of the things that really spoke to you?
Just kind of the things with everyday struggle kind of things. and dealing with like emotions, you know, especially as like a teenager, obviously you go through a lot of stressful times in your life, and so you listen to these people, and I think it's the same kind of emotions and the same kind of ideas that is present in any genre of music. You know, people latch on to music because it helps them deal with stuff and helps them cope with stuff. I guess I don't really know if I have anything specific, but you know, one group in particular, like I'm not sure if you're familiar with Atmosphere from Minneapolis, but they're a group and they're probably one of the most well known independent groups, and with, you know, they deal with just everyday struggles, relationships, on a realistic level, you know, not like the relationships like you would hear in the more mainstream version of rap music. But
well, and you gave us an example of some hip hop by Atmosphere, so let's listen to a little bit of that.
Sure.
And go play volleyball. God is turning the world in a hurry, cause my attorney didn't put enough girls on the jury. Guilty of dropping these bombs in the city, but I'm innocent. Love is the motive, that's why I'm killing them. Guilty of setting my fire in all 50, but I'm innocent. Blame it on my equilibrium. In the days of kings and queens, I was a jester. Treat me like a god, or they treat me like a leper. You see me move back and forth between both. I'm trying to find a balance, I'm trying to build a balance. In the days of kings and queens, I was a jester. Treat me like a god, or they treat me like a leper.
All right, that's a sample of some music from Atmosphere, and you're talking about this underground world of hip-hop. How would you define underground as far as in this genre?
Yeah, that's always a trick. And you know, there's a couple different schools of thought with that, and you know, some people just don't even recognize the difference. But the way that we focus it on our site is we try to focus on people who are independent, meaning that they're not signed to major labels. And a lot of these artists, it's not like they're working to try to be signed to a major label. It's that they choose to live outside of that. And you know, Atmosphere is a good example of that, because they're a group that they've worked with like Epitaph, which is a large independent record label, but they've actually built their own label in Minneapolis, and they are now signing independent artists to their label, and they've been offered major deals with some other groups like Warner and groups like that, and they've turned them down because they don't want to ruin what they've built, I guess.
There are probably a lot of people who read your magazine if they find out more about you, and probably people listening right now who think, well, what's a white kid from Cedar Rapids doing starting a hip hop magazine? So how do you interact with this world, being someone who lives in Iowa and didn't grow up in this culture?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I guess that speaks kind of to the point of the website, which is that I guess people have this idea that if you're a white kid from Iowa, that you can't relate to rap music, you can't relate to hip hop because it's so removed. And I think that's built largely on this foundation of, well, rap music is about guns, money, and you know, living in New York. And once you get past that and you realize that there's rap music from Idaho, there's rap music from wherever, you know, these people, they're not, the subject isn't catered to only that. So my goal is, I guess, to expand people's idea of what hip hop is and really bring to light some of this other stuff, or some of the other the music and the artists that are doing things that are more relevant to more people, and really to open people's minds up on that, because I feel like a lot of people are close-minded, and you say, you know, oh, I have a hip hop magazine, and they instantly they kind of give you that look like, what, you have a hip hop magazine? So, you know, my goal is really to break down some of those barriers, I guess.
So when did this magazine first launch?
I bought the domain name and got it started set up last spring, but the spring before that. And so in July of 2009 is when I started to really work on it, and it's kind of taken different iterations since then. But
okay, so it's been just over a year since you launched this magazine, really.
Around 18 months.
When you first started writing it, how did you make connections from your position of power here in Iowa? How did you make connections
sure,
in this world?
Sure. Social media. mostly. And, you know, just reaching out to people. And it's not like I went out and interviewed Atmosphere like the first day. It's been a long road trying to build those connections. And like I said, I did have some connections kind of coming into it with my friend Chris from New York, who's the guy who kind of originally put me onto a lot of the artists that I'm a big fan of now. And he, you know, he knew a lot of people that were kind of in that world. So he put me in touch with some people. And then from there, I just kind of built relationships with everyone. And I mean, there's still people that I haven't really gotten in contact with, but...
You're working on it.
Yeah, exactly.
So your magazine has 10,000 subscribers right now online and growing at the moment. Tell me about an experience that you had when you first started out, and you didn't have 10,000 readers, so you didn't have that to barter with, where you got in touch with an artist and convinced them to be a part of this magazine.
Initially, a lot of times I didn't. I would reach out to people and I would just never get a response from them, or you know, or they would just say they didn't have time or something like that. What we did with a lot of groups, there's a record label on the East Coast called Strange Famous Records, and they're home to a lot of a fairly well-known independent artists. And what we did with them is we started at some of with their lesser known artists, and we worked with them, and we got them some promotion on our website. And then that kind of caught the attention of some of their bigger artists, and they reached out to us, and they've been willing to work with us since then. And you know, some of the behind the scenes people in their organization, they really, I guess, kind of latched onto the energy that we had, and so they've been more than happy to work with us since then.
You keep using the term "we." How many people do work on your magazine now?
It's 7 or 8, and we kind of have a revolving door. We have people that kind of come and go, just whenever they have time. No one's paid; it's all volunteer. So it's stressful sometimes trying to keep the content coming, but we do what we can.
And of course, you are calling it a magazine. It's a website. You have an e-magazine that you send out
Sure.
to people's email addresses. How do you update the content on the site? Do you publish an issue, or do you just constantly update the content?
No, it's like a constant stream. Every day we try to get new content up there, whether it's new music or some, you know, a new story about someone's releasing an album or going on tour or an interview. We try and do something every day. That doesn't always happen, but yeah, it's as you go.
Now, you mentioned no one gets paid for this. Is this your occupation, or you have a day job to support this habit?
Yes. I have a day job. You know, I hope one day it can be. I haven't quite figured out the way to monetize it yet, but we'll see.
Well, you and everyone else is trying to solve that puzzle
yes,
on the internet.
I'll let you guys know when I figure it out.
But what are your hopes for the future of the magazine?
My hopes for the future are just to continue what we've built and keep growing it. And you know, success in my eyes is helping the artists grow. Because that's, you know, when I first started, that was my biggest thing. Was I sat down and I said, okay, now I know about all these artists. Why is there no magazine or no news source where I can go and find out about these guys? Why is there nobody covering them or interviewing them? I want to know more about them. And that kind of is what sparked that idea, you know, back 8 years ago or so.
Well, you sent us some other cuts, so why don't we listen to Gangstar, and then you can tell us a little bit about
yeah.
the people behind this music.
Sure.
Break it. Step into my zone, mad rhymes will stifle ya. Lines like rifles go blast when I kick some. A lot of rappers be like one-time wonders. Couldn't say a fly rhyme if there was one right under their noses. I hate those motherfucking poses, but I'm so real to them it's scary. And with my unique skills, nah, you can't compare me.
All right, so that's the group Gangstar. Tell me about them.
Gangstar is actually a pretty old group, and Guru, that's the MC, he actually recently passed away. The producer and DJ, his name is DJ Premier. He's very well known nowadays, but when these guys first came out back in the day, they're pretty much credited with creating what's known as sort of the New York style of hip hop or rap music as known, which is, you know, it's very like gritty and it's sample based. You hear the samples that it uses in the beat, and that song in particular, I actually just listened to an interview with DJ Premier recently, and he was talking about how they made that song. It's called Mass Appeal, and they actually made it because right around that time in the early 90s is when radio really started to pick up on rap music. And people were coming out with songs that they thought were corny or whatever, and they were doing it, and they thought they were doing it just to get on the radio, and so they made that song to kind of poke fun at these other people that they thought were kind of deviating from that style.
You have 10,000 readers right now. What is your relationship with them like? Do you interact a lot with people who are reading your stuff?
I try to. We're on Twitter and Facebook and on all those good things. Twitter.com/aboveground mag, Facebook.com/aboveground magazine, shameless plug. a lot of the people that really interact with our magazine are actually artists. We can't cover everyone, and we try to cover as many people as we can. And so a lot of people that we do cover, they really show us a lot of mutual respect back, and they support what we're doing. And they are a lot of the artists are the people that are actually reading the magazine quite frequently. So we do interact with people quite a bit.
Have you had a moment where, I don't know if you've heard from an artist or you've heard from someone where you really had that feeling of epiphany? Yeah, we've made it. We're really making a difference.
There's a guy from Wisconsin, and he started up. Or he, I don't know if he actually started it, but he's the editor-in-chief of a print magazine in Wisconsin called 608, and it's a regional, local hip-hop magazine there. And I'd never seen him or spoken to him or anything, and he, one day on Twitter, he just said, you know, Above Ground Magazine is a really good, much-needed source for underground hip-hop news and information. Or something along those lines, and I just read that, and I was like, "That's exactly the point." So I was glad.
So you mentioned you have a day job to support this magazine. I have to imagine that although hosting a web domain is not an expensive thing, it's still probably an expensive habit. So how far can you go before you figure out how to monetize it?
That's a good question. I guess I don't know. We're kind of at the point where we need to start now, I guess. We're getting there. We need to expand, actually, like our hosting and stuff like that. So the next step is going to be significantly more expensive. That would probably require us to have some sort of revenue stream.
All right. Well, when you figure out how to make it work, let us know.
I will do that.
Tyler, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tyler Hakes is a recent graduate of the University of Iowa. He's also the creator and editor-in-chief of the hip-hop magazine called Above Ground. You can find him online at abovegroundmagazine.com. We'll also put a link to that on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow at this time, you'll hear Turkey Confidential from The Splendid Table with Lynn Rosetto Casper. You can find out more about that on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Get by, just get by, just get by, just get by. After a while, some people got a lip in the trailer, cuss like a sailor. I paint a picture with the pen like Norman Mailer. Me and Weller raised.